Chapter 7. Acclimatizing Pests, Vegetable. Plants can do everything animals can do, only more slowly, a biologist friend once observed. When it comes to invasion, plants can do even more than animals, sometimes faster. That is why the unintended consequences of new plants can be even more drastic than those of introduced animals. Plants and animals alike accompanied Europeans in the global extension of their settlements, described memorably by Alfred W. Crosby as a, quote, grunting, lowing, neighing, crowing, chirping, snarling, buzzing, self-replicating, and world-altering avalanche, unquote. Domestic cattle, swine, and horses brought by the Europeans to the Americas not only tended to run wild themselves, they depended on plants unintentionally introduced with crop seeds, plants that the settlers condemned as weeds. These plants have many of the qualities we have seen in pest animals. They are prolific. Their seeds disperse quickly and far. They germinate early. Some also form superplants, connected by underground rhizomes, that choke out other plant life. They displace and overshadow. They profit from the absence of the natural predators of their homelands. They thrive in harsh conditions and germinate after decades. Just as carp can proliferate in polluted reservoirs and starlings roost in city trees, weeds survive in hostile habitats. After all, they evolved to cope with the conditions left by the end of the Ice Age in Europe. In fact, the only thing that appears to stop weeds is their own ability to stabilize the soil. The longer an area has been left untouched, the fewer weeds it has. The European occupiers of North America and elsewhere have had to deal with so many pests because they disrupted the land so profoundly and continue to modify it so intensively. The botanist W. Holzner has defined weeds as, quote, plants adapted to man-made habitats and interfering there with human activities, unquote. One definition of a true weed might be a plant with a built-in revenge effect, i.e., a plant that actually profits from attempts to eradicate it. Cutting plantain triggers new shoots from its hidden rhizomes. Burning wetland vegetation to destroy purple loosestrife exposes the soil to sunlight, thereby hastening the germination of still more loosestrife. Ripping out other species, as the garden writer Michael Pollan discovered of burdock, leaves a taproot that will send up more. The root of bindweed, a destructive vine that stifles its plant hosts, easily falls into pieces from which new plants sprout. Quote, it is as though bindweed's evolution took the hoe into account, Pollan observes. By attacking it at the root, I played right into its insidious strategy for world domination, unquote. The same thing happened in the 1930s when a Chicago physician led a campaign to eradicate ragweed. His corps of volunteers killed countless plants, but inevitably dispersed pollen that increased the range and intensity of the city's ragweed crop. Like the problem animals we have seen, some of the most serious plant pests have entered North America on the recommendations of experts, scientists, government officials, seed merchants, and nursery owners. David Fairchild, former head of the United States Office of Plant Introduction, mentioned casually in a travel book his organization's, quote, introduction of nearly 200,000 named species and varieties of plants from all over the world, unquote. Novelty and perceived beauty have counted at least as much as utility. Some experts did not understand how dramatically new plants could transform the landscape. Others did, but failed to foresee all of the consequences that might ensue. And like controversial introduced animals, many weeds have their admirers and defenders. For example, growers and buyers of costly dandelion greens, or admirers of cheeky urban vegetation like the ailanthus, the tree that grows in Brooklyn and other cities where more sensitive species often succumb to fumes and vandals. Ailanthus, too, tends to send out new shoots and reappear where it has been cut. There are enough hardy urban plants that one botanist has found over 400 in inner-city Cleveland, and others encountered rare orchids growing wild on the shores of a Schenectady, New York lake and on southern Arizona rangeland. Still other plants, endangered in their original habitats, may ultimately be saved from extinction by their persistence as wild vegetation in abandoned English gardens. Sometimes weeds may be promoted, and the Netherlands has picking gardens from which children and adults can take colorful weed flowers home. The motto of weed appreciators everywhere must be Ralph Waldo Emerson's definition, a plant whose uses are not yet known. There are also important differences between animal and plant pests that must not be overlooked. Weeds seize open, disturbed territory. They usually do not compete aggressively with native wild plants. Development divides habitats into smaller zones separated by roads, housing, and industry. As more regions are thus broken into islands and stressed by human activities, plant invaders can transform their habitats far more radically than even the hungriest and most prolific insect, bird, or mammalian newcomers. Reshaping the landscape, they can exclude other vegetation on which valuable and rare animal species depend. Weeds may only be taking advantage of more fragile habitats. But a small number have turned from squatters into environmental storm troops. Whether suppressed or allowed to run their course, they unleash natural warfare by their very presence. Invasive plants depend upon technology for their dispersal even more than their animal counterparts. We have seen how the gypsy moth achieved its foothold in the Boston area through pre-motorized suburban traffic. Railroad cars, followed by automobiles and trucks, did the rest. Railroads also helped establish carp across the country within 20 years. Human transportation was just as essential for plant invaders. The earliest railroads changed the vegetation of North America, not only spreading weeds, but even preserving weeds that had become rare plants where farmers had all but eradicated them. The fencing that railroads and farmers alike erected to protect the trains from cattle, cowcatchers did not really do the job, also saved the plants from beasts that would otherwise have munched them. Passing trains spread seeds throughout the network. They helped introduce the tumbleweed, Salsola kali, to the Intermountain West. It is not an indigenous American plant at all. It is a European weed that, when dead and dry, easily detaches from its roots to form one of the rare rolling objects in nature, the better to distribute its seeds. As some of the early weeds grew rare in the agrarian landscape, the railroad right-of-way became both their protective reserve and their means of propagation. As North American settlement spread westward, the plants of the Old World invaded with it. Weed seeds traveled in the wagons of the pioneers and on their horses' hooves. Vendors used them to adulterate commercial seed shipments until the United States and Canada enacted pure seed legislation in the early 20th century. Government agencies and other national organizations spread weeds, too. U.S. Navy officers and diplomatic personnel routinely brought back plants and seeds they thought might be of economic or aesthetic interest. In 1839, the U.S. Congress gave the Patent Office funds for obtaining new plants from around the world. Crabgrass, actually various grasses of the genus Digitaria, was among its early discoveries. In fairness to the bureaucracy, these grasses are good forage crops in Europe, and immigrant farmers brought and prized them too. It was not until the 1860s that Frederick Law Olmsted and other landscape architects popularized the idea of detached houses planted in a park-like expanse of grass. The introduction of the first compact lawnmowers about this same time helped make the suburbs, literally in the urban historian Kenneth Jackson's phrase, a crabgrass frontier. Two kinds of intensiveness, each reasonable in its place, combined with unfortunate results. Crabgrass was hardy, tenacious, and easy to propagate. The lawn was a carefully managed zone rich in nutrients. The federal government also helped generously with another weedy plant that it later disavowed, hemp, or cannabis sativa. Like crabgrass, hemp can be valuable. Thomas Jefferson grew it for fiber. So did countless 19th-century Americans. And it was not only legal, but patriotic. For decades before the War of 1812, the U.S. Navy did its best to promote a domestic hemp industry. In 1877-78 alone, helped by the National Railroad and Postal Network, the Department of Agriculture distributed 339 samples of hemp and 343 of opium poppies. As late as the 1890s, Special Agent Charles Richards Dodge, in charge of fiber investigations for the USDA, was promoting cannabis in the department's yearbook as, quote, so generally cultivated the world over as a cordage fiber that the value of all other fibers as to strength and durability is estimated by it, unquote. Birds relish hemp seeds, and breeders fought anti-marijuana legislation in the 20th century. Nevertheless, neither the Navy nor the USDA had much success with cannabis. As a fiber, plebeian hemp, curiously like aristocratic silk, demands skilled hand processing. Raising it has always been a cottage industry. Even before the ban on cannabis, none of the estimated hundreds of patented hemp cleaning machines was effective. And yet hemp was grown widely enough, thanks to commercial seed catalogs as well as to government encouragement, that the wild form of cannabis has survived into the late 20th century as ditchweed. Curiously, Americans believed until this century that only South Asian hemp, C. indica, was suitable for drug production. And ironically, the application of severe anti-drug laws to marijuana in the 1980s and 1990s encouraged illicit growers to hybridize C. sativa with C. indica, breeding compact plants ideal for clandestine, often automated indoor cultivation. Production soared. In 1995, cannabis was the biggest American cash crop in dollar volume, exceeding corn and soybeans combined. In fact, the botanist Richard N. Mack has argued that the seed trade not only introduced future pests, but made them more serious by its methods. An invasive plant once had to make one journey at a time to extend its range. Catalog sales, affected by railroad transportation of seeds, could establish plants at the same time in locations hundreds or thousands of miles apart. Each of these, in turn, could become a secondary point of distribution. Today, of course, air transportation is an even faster way to do the same thing internationally. A woody plant distributed as a seed has already shown its ability to reproduce sexually in a way that one sold as a seedling or as a plant grown from a cutting has not. 19th century seedsmen did not breed today's sterile hybrids or select for domestication. Their seeds were much more likely than today's to survive in the wild. And, of course, commercial seeds get more attention and grow more densely than plants that spread accidentally, and are that much more likely to reproduce naturally. The seed trade, especially before 20th century regulation and hybridization, diffused plants less as a wave and more as a rain of widely spaced missiles with living payloads. In at least one case in Nevada, a well-meaning state agent for agricultural experiments included actual dried weeds, seeds and all, in bulletins he circulated warning farmers to beware of them. These samples, in fact, may well have introduced the weed, Mack believes. Automobiles encouraged their own revenge plant, the puncture vine, or Tribulus terrestris. This had been a rare species in California until the motor boom of the 1920s, when better roads and heavier traffic helped spread it throughout the state. The sharp spines of Tribulus seed pods deflated and weakened tires. The California Highway Commission recommended repeated and costly spraying of roadside plants with diesel fuel. It also acknowledged that unless neighboring private lands were also treated, quote, our work will avail nothing, as these areas will be reseeded from outside faster than we can eradicate, unquote. Modern tires have ended the puncture vine menace for motorists, but it remains a hazard for bicyclists in the American Southwest. Motor vehicles are not the only innovation that has changed a manageable plant into a runaway menace. Along the rivers of the Southwest, the salt cedar, or tamarisk, a Eurasian tree, was introduced in the late 18th century for shade, wood, and flood control. It spread slowly during the 19th century. Then, in the early 1900s, it seemed to sweep through the Southwest. Like other invaders, it had fecundity and swift growth on its side. One tree sends forth 500,000 minute airborne seeds annually, and those that sprout can grow to 10 feet in their first year. The plant ecologist Duncan Patton and others believe that dams have given the tamarisk a crucial edge by suppressing the natural flooding that favored the seed release schedules of its native competitors, the cottonwoods and willows. Patton also points to the rise of grazing and the greater appeal of the native plants to cattle. These changes transformed a useful homesteader's plant into a rampant invader covering a million acres, displacing native trees, and dropping leaves that release so much salt that the soil may not support other vegetation. Declining productivity, in turn, depletes wildlife. Their spread also creates revenge effects for dam builders. Thriving along the edges of reservoirs, they pump priceless western water into the atmosphere. The tamarisks of the American Southwest are said to soak up twice as much water every year as all the cities of Southern California use. Restoring natural river conditions and restricting grazing can limit their expansion, but control usually demands labor-intensive burning, poisoning, plowing, and even covering with plastic bags. Kudzu. Salt cedar is not the only beneficial plant to turn Frankenstein monster, and hemp is not the only government introduction that has resulted in a drastic reversal of policy. Kudzu, Prieraria lobata, or P. montana, a semi-wild leguminous vine native to Asia, thrives in the most neglected and abused soils. It diffuses by rooted nodes. The woody kudzu root is virtually a mini-tree, up to 7 feet long, and weighing as much as 400 pounds. In Japan, its powdered root is a prized, starchy ingredient, delicate enough to be served as an appetizer on handmade porcelain in the nation's most refined Zen temple restaurants. The kudzu leaf adorns family crests. Introduced to North America at the Philadelphia Centennial Exposition in 1876, kudzu became a popular ornamental plant for shading porches. There it stayed. Rarely can it propagate by disseminating its seeds. It was government agricultural experts who turned kudzu into a pest. Hydrilla, kudzu's waterborne counterpart, entered the United States as an aquarium plant without any sponsorship by experts, and thus cannot be counted as a revenge effect. David Fairchild, then already a celebrated plant hunter for the USDA Bureau of Plant Industry, brought kudzu to America again around the turn of the century, just as private farmers were starting to use it experimentally on worn-out pastureland. Before this reintroduction, Fairchild had to spend more than 200 pre-First World War dollars removing kudzu vines that were climbing pine trees on his own property and bending them to the ground, yet he seems to have found no reason for cautioning others about the plant. Some farmers needed no encouragement. One Florida man, a former school superintendent, called for planting it on half the cultivable land in his county. Quote, "It would bring us $15 million to $35 million instead of the measly little pittance we now get from King Cotton," unquote. During the New Deal, the U.S. Soil Conservation Service advocated kudzu as a plant that could restore southern cotton lands devastated by insects, erosion, and the Depression. They were right to admire its vigor. Like weeds, kudzu flourishes in disturbed and marginal settings, resists insects and drought, needs no preparation of the soil or fertilizer, and above all, grows rapidly. An acre of kudzu left unchecked, one enthusiast calculated, would expand to 13,000 acres in the course of a century. Growing at up to a foot a day in the spring, kudzu tendrils can extend 60 feet within a season and overgrow objects as high as 40 feet. Its lush growth keeps the soil cool and moist. As a ground cover, kudzu cuts water runoff by 80%. Land planted with kudzu loses 99% less soil than land planted with cotton. It restores soil nutrients and makes good pasturage and hay, though milk from kudzu-fed cows is not always palatable. No wonder the Soil Conservation Service sent 73 million kudzu seedlings to farmers and civilian conservation corps groups and paid $6 to $8 per acre for planting it. By the end of the Second World War, a 500,000 acres of the American Southeast were planted in kudzu. Private boosters of the miracle vine took over where the New Deal had left off. Channing Cope, the man who made the 13,000, I estimate, founded the Kudzu Club of America, aiming to raise the national acreage to 8 million. Yet only 10 years later, farmers and federal officials alike were condemning kudzu as a nuisance plant. The vine had not changed, but agriculture had. Southern landowners were letting forests grow back. Kudzu climbs, overshades, and kills saplings and even 100-foot-tall trees. In 1988, a U.S. Forestry Service official estimated timber losses caused by kudzu in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi at up to $175 million. It hogs potential forest land. Kudzu was also less attractive to cattle and milk producers who wanted more productive feed crops and were willing to spend more fertilizer and attention on them. Even for erosion control, new and more manageable plants had appeared. Partly because of its own Depression-era success, kudzu was becoming technologically obsolete. The Soil Conservation Service, which once promoted it, has officially been calling it a weed ever since 1970. Kudzu may have fallen from federal grace, not entirely, as we will see, but it no longer depends on it. Without diseases or North American insect enemies, it has continued to thrive throughout the Southeast. Unwelcome down on the farm, kudzu has invaded the technological infrastructure of the flourishing Eastern Sunbelt with a vengeance. It pulls down telephone poles, blacks out neighborhoods by warming local power transformers until they trip, and shorts high-voltage lines on long-distance electric transmission towers. Once planted by highway departments to stabilize roadsides, it now obliterates traffic signs and spreads over bridges. On railroad grades, kudzu grows over the rails and slickens tracks as trains crush it. Locomotives eventually lose traction. In fact, kudzu can overwhelm and envelop nearly any stationary object. Unmoved automobiles, sidetracked railroad cars, abandoned houses, even, so says Southern folklore, unconscious drunks. Kudzu is not as vigorous as other problem plants. It can die from accidental or deliberate overgrazing, but a remnant will always be out of reach. Cattle don't climb trees, as the authors of one book on the subject point out. Killing the kudzu means finding and destroying all of its root crowns. Just one can regenerate all that was uprooted. Farmers have to slash vines and trees around borders. The arsenal of herbicides used against kudzu continues to grow, but many products can harm desirable plants. And there is a special revenge effect in poisoning kudzu. Exposure of the soil for up to a year after all vegetation has been killed can renew the very erosion that kudzu was introduced to halt. It is not entirely surprising, then, that soon after it stigmatized kudzu, the Soil Conservation Service was distributing samples again, cautiously. Perhaps Japan's refusal to provide more seeds was a sign that the plant is more a trade secret than a menace. In the 1970s and 1980s, its Zen connections, ability to grow without and in spite of chemicals, and value as natural food and fiber, brought kudzu from New Deal to New Age. Still, it is not certain whether there can be lasting détente with kudzu. Scientists at Florida's Department of Natural Resources took notice in August 1992 when visiting herbicide specialists from Alabama and Georgia pointed out a few specimens growing along several miles of levee in South Florida's canal system. They had thought it would never move south of Ocala. They saw immediately that it could overwhelm not only the remaining native vegetation, but even the previous aggressive invaders, which we will see, of the Everglades, turning the park into little more than a huge kudzu patch. Isolated as the plants turned out to be, they reminded biologists of how much vigilance a chronic problem organism demands. Multiflora rose. If kudzu has settled into an uncertain middle age as a naturalized plant, even an emblem of a whole region, Multiflora rose, Rosa multiflora, is still an unruly adolescent. Like kudzu, Multiflora is an Asian plant that gardeners and homeowners adopted in the 19th century. It is an excellent rootstock and was hybridized with other rose varieties. It is a healthy plant with few insect pests. Birds and other wildlife love the fruit. Added to the hundreds of other rose varieties in common cultivation, it probably had a negligible environmental impact in the 19th century. Then, beginning with the Depression, the Soil Conservation Service and other federal and state agencies discovered and promoted it. Like kudzu, Multiflora stabilized worn-out soil. It smelled sweet, looked good, and provided a natural protective fence for crops. Over two decades until 1960, farmers in North Carolina alone planted between 14 and 20 million roses, and others in West Virginia set out more than 14 million. Multiflora windbreaks even arose in the Great Plains. Multiflora's 19th century virtues became, at least for the farmers whom the Soil Conservation Service were trying to help, 20th century vices. A single plant, according to James W. Amrine, Jr. of the West Virginia University Division of Plant and Soil Sciences, can produce 500,000 or even 1,000,000 seeds in a good year. Multiflora's attractiveness to songbirds like robins and mockingbirds ensures that some of these seeds are spread when excreted. Songbirds do not grind up seeds as chickens, turkeys, and other gallinaceous birds do, but often pass them intact. The process actually makes the seeds twice as likely to germinate, according to one study. The government-sponsored overextension of this attractive and durable plant, coupled with its ability to spread and its tenacity once established, brought out its weedy potential. Even in the 1930s, Kentucky and a few other states realized the hazard and limited multiflora planting. A leading Indiana botanist, alarmed by proposals to plant old cemeteries with multiflora, wrote to a correspondent that, "When Gabriel sounds his horn, I am afraid some will be stranded and not be able to get through the roses. Please do not recommend the multiflora rose except for the bonfire." In the 1960s, his fears were realized. Multiflora had spread to hill slopes, roadways, and other marginal lands. First West Virginia, then Iowa, Illinois, Kansas, Maryland, Missouri, Ohio, and Pennsylvania branded it a noxious weed. In West Virginia, vocational agriculture teachers and county agents called it the state's most serious agricultural problem, according to one survey in the 1980s. In North Carolina, over 2 million acres of former meadow are now dense with multiflora. The living fences of multiflora, far from merely bordering and protecting fields, have overrun them. Grazing and farming are impossible where it thrives. For the last 30 years, farmers have been trying to cut it, rip it, level it, burn it, poison it, and overgraze it with the last resort of herbicides, goats. Unlike kudzu, multiflora has promising natural predators and diseases. There are tiny wasps, roseseed chalcids, Megastigmus aculeatus nigroflavus, that lay their eggs in up to half the viable seeds, destroying them as they mature. Chalcids may eventually destroy up to 9 out of 10 multiflora seeds. Unfortunately, so many multiflora were planted as cuttings that control by the chalcids will have to wait until they disperse naturally, which means slowly, perhaps more than 20 years. Another insect, the rose-stem girdler, does just what its name implies, damaging the stems of mature plants when its larvae emerge, but it does not kill enough plants for serious control. There are also mites that carry rose rosette disease, RRD, also known as witch's broom of rose, often attributed to a virus but not really understood. The mites and RRD had spread to the east from the western windbreaks by the early 1990s by way of the Ohio Valley and West Virginia, and appeared destined to spread on prevailing winds to New England. RRD does not appear to threaten economically important fruit trees, but its use has potential revenge effects of its own. Because many plants with RRD show no signs of disease, the virus could easily spread inadvertently. Although some species appear to be unaffected, other rose varieties could be devastated by RRD. If the mites that carry it were transported to East Asia, they could infect the local multiflora rose populations. There, multiflora is not a pest at all, but an important and appreciated plant. James Amrine fears the mites may, like gypsy moths, Dutch elm disease, and chestnut blight, become even more serious problems overseas than in their home countries. Multiflora shows that, given enough encouragement by experts, even an apparently well-behaved ornamental plant can turn into an officially condemned pest within 30 years. It also shows that biological control is neither fast nor free from revenge effects of its own. Future weeds, Kogan grass. Because the garden seed and nursery businesses are as devoted to the impulses of fashion as they are to the demands of agriculture, and because the technology of transporting and propagating exotics continues to improve, new candidates for acclimatizing will continue to appear. Even as the environmental left arm of the federal bureaucracy points its accusing finger at non-indigenous species, the agricultural right arm will continue to extend at least a wary handshake. After all, one reason to encourage and maintain a diversity of life on Earth is the opportunity this affords to study and introduce beneficial species. But acclimatizing studies can have revenge effects delayed by decades. Kogan grass, Imparata cylindrica, which is starting to claim large areas in Florida and elsewhere in the southeast, has tall, sharp, spiky leaves. When scientists at the beef cattle laboratories of the U.S. Department of Agriculture near Brooksville, Florida, first imported it, probably from China, its toothed edges discouraged cattle from grazing. The USDA dropped the project. The trouble was that seeds somehow were spread, and Kogan grass turned out to flourish along roadsides, at the edges of pine plantations, and in other places where it was not as conspicuous as kudzu, but displaced more valuable native vegetation. Other animals evidently found it as unpalatable as did the cows, and Florida's rich insect fauna would not touch it. The underground shoots or rhizomes of Kogan grass are massive and durable. Beneath a single acre of the plant may be 3 tons of rhizomes, which retain water efficiently and may work their way up to 4 feet within the soil. Botanists believe the rhizomes produce chemicals that limit the growth of other plant species. Whatever the reason, few other kinds of plants are found in dense patches of Kogan grass. By the mid-1990s, Kogan grass was joining the list of Florida's problem imports.
"Once we became aware of it, we began to see it everywhere," said one Florida state land manager. "Up and down the highways, everywhere. The citrus tract in the Withlacoochee State Forest is just loaded with it. If you keep your eyes open, you'll start finding it everywhere."
A state task force has been studying the plant. The agronomist who heads it believes Kogan grass is already widespread in the southeast. In the absence of biological control, Florida officials can only apply massive doses of herbicides with names like Arsenal and Roundup. And the rhizomes of Kogan grass demand unusually thorough treatment if the plants are not to grow back rapidly. Exploding trees. While herbaceous plants and vines may spread to become nuisances on a regional and even national scale, new trees can be more troublesome locally. Trees can be weeds, too, especially when removed from their native growing conditions and insect predators. In areas of rapid development with disrupted landscapes, like the foothills of California and the waterways of southern Florida, trees have been among the most controversial of plant introductions. Of all the developed world's landscapes, southern Florida's has been changed in as many ways and for as many reasons in as short a time as any other. It is actually a recent landscape. Much of it was below sea level 5,000 years ago. The biologist Daniel Simberloff has called the region, quote, a habitat island, bounded on 3 sides by water, the 4th side by forest, and typified, as are oceanic islands, by an impoverished native flora and fauna, unquote. Lightning strikes and fires are frequent. Underlying soils are nutrient poor and easily modified by human activity like agriculture, tree farming, and housing. Lakes and rivers are abundant. The relative absence of stream channels can expose plants to new water conditions when ditches and dikes are built miles away. These and other changes can alter the structure of biological communities and weaken their competitive advantage against newcomers. And like other disruptions, they prepare territory for weedy plants. Generations of canal building have changed a seasonally flooded wetland southeast of Lake Okeechobee into 1 million acres of agricultural and developed land. Florida's economic boom has been an ecological disaster for the wetlands of the Everglades, where vital water sources have been diminished and polluted by fertilizer runoff. Environmental scientists have been increasingly concerned about the kind of fragmentation Florida has undergone. When native vegetation is cleared away, even the areas not directly touched are subject to stress. Agriculture and building tend to increase the range of temperatures, with hotter days, cooler nights, and more frequent frosts. Boundaries between types of vegetation change wind patterns, exposing native plants to more weather damage and enabling seeds, insects, and diseases to migrate into undeveloped zones. Isolation reduces the number of species each remnant can support. Many animals specialize in living where 2 natural zones meet,
areas that border on development, and are biologically poorer and more stressed than those in the interior. Florida itself is a border state, a port of entry for tourists, business visitors, immigrants, and migrants from all of North and South America and Europe, all potential importers of new life forms. The Port of Miami is also one of the busiest East Coast shipping centers, with double the exports of Baltimore and catching up on the value of its imports. Plenty of the merchandise, too, is living. Florida is the major center of U.S. tropical fish importing and an exotic vegetation supermarket. Vendors of aquatic plants, including some from as far away as North Carolina, until relatively recently used Florida's public drainage canals, ditches, and other waterways to plant and grow their stock without maintaining expensive nurseries. And despite Canada's embargo in the face of the Africanized bee hazard, Florida is still a prime wintering ground for hives from the northern states of the United States. Not surprisingly, Florida now has over 900 introduced plant species, over 100 of which have been classified as environmentally hazardous invaders by the state's Exotic Pest Plant Council, an organization of state and federal biologists studying the invaders. Of the troublesome newcomers, a number of the most disturbing were brought not by naive householders or optimistic nurserymen, but by professionals, public officials, and academics who were trying to improve and restore the environment. One plant explorer from the Department of Agriculture introduced Brazilian pepper, Scinus terebinthifolius, in 1898, and the USDA Plant Introduction Station in Miami made it available to amateur gardeners. The railroad builder Henry Nerling, aided by friends in the nursery business, also distributed thousands of the plants. By the late 1980s, it occupied thousands of acres of South and Central Florida, the American Southwest, and Hawaii. This evergreen, growing up to 40 feet high, has drupes that turn bright red late in the year and has been popularly known as Florida holly and Christmas berry. It also grows aggressively and can produce rashes on human contact. It turned out to be closely related to poison ivy. Probably because Brazilian pepper affects wetlands and their wildlife more than agriculture, the Florida legislature has been slow to appropriate funds for the plant's control, even though state law classifies it among the prohibited aquatic species. Brazilian pepper is now rampant in central Florida, especially along the drainage channels and ditches in Brevard County, and has become a serious concern of residents. In the Gulf Coast mangrove forest of the Everglades National Park, it has been spreading from disturbed former agricultural lands to the previously untouched zone. Flood control measures, hurricanes, frost, and even large flocks of migratory robins eating berries and dispersing seeds have combined to make the plant a major problem. The robins may have regretted their feast. The berries can be as unfit for avian as for human consumption. It was into the disturbed wetlands of South Florida that Melaleuca quinquinervia was introduced. Melaleuca was another pest tree transplanted by professionals with the best of intentions. John C. Gifford was not only a real estate developer and nurseryman, but a forester at the University of Miami. He brought the first trees to Florida in 1906, and soon Melaleuca was spreading to coastal wetlands. But it was Gifford's colleague, Hully Sterling, who decided to restore the trees of the Everglades by scattering Melaleuca seeds from the air. Just as aviation was to broadcast the safe pesticides of the post-war period over millions of acres, it was able to transform a landscape overnight in 1936. There is no record of any federal, state, or local opposition to the airdrop. Farmers also planted Melaleuca as windbreaks and fence rows, and its rapid growth rate made it appealing for home landscaping. By the 1970s, Melaleuca had spread into most of the water conservation areas of the Everglades, where Florida authorities have called it the most serious threat to the Everglades ecosystem. In 1980, it covered 6% of South Florida land, including almost 13% of undeveloped wetlands. By 1993, it was estimated that Melaleuca covered at least 380,000 acres, with some estimates exceeding 1.5 million, with a growth rate of 50 acres a day. Some believe Melaleuca could eventually increase to 10 times its present population. Melaleuca is an Australian and Malaysian tree that has no native insect enemies in Florida. It grows at an average rate of more than 6 feet per year, reaching heights of 100 feet, and may live for 70 years or more. Stands of young trees reach exceptional density, choking out most native vegetation and supporting little wildlife even after they thin out. Melaleuca is sensitive to frost. Only isolated trees have been seen in North Florida, but flourishes in soils that experience some flooding. With several times more leaf surface than native sawgrass, it loses much more water to the atmosphere. Melaleuca's Australian heritage helps account for its literally explosive growth. It belongs to a group of plants that propagated themselves with fire. Like Australia, Florida has a high rate of lightning strikes, which often set fire to vegetation. In Melaleuca, these fires not only spread readily to the flammable bark, but can trigger an oil in its leaves that makes the tree's crown burn explosively, releasing seeds. In Florida, the extreme heat at which it burns, 1500 degrees Fahrenheit, explodes native hardwoods nearby and can set off intense peat fires that change soil concentrations irreversibly, causing alterations in one season that otherwise would take thousands of years. Melaleuca does not need fire to reproduce. Wind and other disturbances can also break open the seed capsules. Wintering bees from the north love Melaleuca flowers and may have done their part to help the trees spread by pollinating them. In fact, the only important benefit of Melaleuca appears to be that honeybee hives attracted by it contribute millions of dollars to the value of other crops pollinated and cross-fertilized by the bees. Once Melaleuca covers more than 75% of an area, native fish, amphibians, birds, and reptiles decline in number, and invasions of frogs, rats, and house mice increase. In the 1990s, biologists are trying to save the Everglades from the airborne mission to restore them. Like many other chronic problems, Melaleuca can be spread easily, but managed and controlled only painstakingly. Contrary to the expectations of the foresters who seeded it, Melaleuca is a poor source of wood and expensive to harvest. The equipment that could remove it leaves ruts in the soft soil, changing its topography. The best-known methods are pulling trees by hand and girdling trunks and applying a herbicide. But after removing Melaleuca, conservation officials must return 7 to 9 months later to pull up seedlings. From a few hundred to as many as 18,000 can germinate after one tree is disturbed. And no herbicide that can treat large areas of soil has been approved for standing water. State and federal entomologists are testing imported Melaleuca-eating Australian insects, including a weevil and a sawfly, which don't appear to find any Native American vegetation palatable. But it is not clear that funds will be available to continue the tests and introduce the insects, or that any insects will be able to multiply quickly enough to keep the rampant Melaleuca in check. The experiment in restoring the Everglades may yet lead to its devastation. Melaleuca is a localized pest. It needs such a hot, wet climate that it can thrive only in a small area of North America. The genus Eucalyptus, another Australian emigrant tree, is as versatile as Melaleuca is restricted, and in different ways just as problematic. Most people who live with eucalypts don't consider them pests. In fact, eucalypts are among the planet's most versatile and valued trees. Cultivated carefully, the deep roots of some species can tap underground water sources unavailable to other plants, increasing the productivity of a managed environment. But some of the very qualities that people prize in them can have unexpected and unpleasant consequences. The environmental historian Stephen J. Pine has called the eucalypt the universal Australian. The eucalypt is a scleromorph, like Melaleuca, one of a family of evergreen trees named for the small, hard leaves that retain nutrients and let the group adapt to many soils, including poor ones. The genus was once limited to a small group in Australasia, but the breakup of Gondwana that began 30 million years ago started it on its way to dominate the vegetation of the new continent, a scleroforest, as Pine puts it. Fire was both a consequence and a cause of this process, as vital as precipitation to a rainforest. Fire selected plants for their adaptation to it, and the spread of the scleromorphs, in turn, ensured that future fires would be well-fueled by plenty of survivors. Eucalypts, thanks to their deep root systems, could find nutrients in a wide variety of soils, extracting phosphorus from sites where more specialized plants would have perished. Equipped with structures called lignotubers, the root systems can store nutrients for up to a decade. The whole tree is a marvel of frugality, optimized to withstand poor soil and drought. Eucalypts co-evolved with the fires that regularly swept Australia. From the roots to the crown, every part of the tree came to withstand combustion and to turn this to its advantage. Its roots were safely buried and could recycle the nutrients that fire deposited, as well as send out new shoots. Fire not only prepared the soil for new trees, it opened clearings necessary for their growth. And since 95% of Australia's forest trees belong to the genus Eucalyptus, its birds and other wildlife came to depend on eucalypts and on the fire regime that sustained them. All this was usually noticed too late by the tree's admirers. The admirers were many. The Acclimatization Society of Paris helped establish experimental stations in Antibes and Algeria as a remedy for deforestation and, it was thought, as a swamp-draining malaria fighter. Famous physicians praised the external disinfecting and internal healing powers of eucalyptus oil, especially against malaria itself. Tolerance for drought and soil varieties helped the tree's popularity wherever frost did not threaten it. Most of the great colonial powers encouraged planting one of the 20 or so species that appeared economically valuable. Less than 100 years ago, under Emperor Menelik II, Ethiopia established a fixed capital for the first time at Addis Ababa, New Flower, after the introduction of eucalypts assured a steady fuel supply. Today, eucalypts thrive throughout Mediterranean Europe and the Middle East, much of Africa, India, and China. In the 20th century, eucalyptus products are staples of the developing world. Hated by many environmental scientists there as pathologically thirsty nuisances, and sometimes as colonial vestiges to boot, eucalypts are nevertheless prized by rural dwellers for their lumber, bark, and leaves. Americans first planted eucalypts in California, where early settlers had burned vast stands of timber in their impatience to start farming, and then confronted a treeless landscape. By the later 19th century, ruinous logging in the forests of the eastern United States, too, led some Californians to campaign for massive eucalyptus plantings in their state to promote local forestry. The president of Santa Barbara College, Elwood Cooper, led the crusade. Cooper imported seeds from Australia and reprinted lectures of Australia's leading botanist, Baron Ferdinand von Mueller, on eucalyptus growing. The trees were beneficial to the soil and profitable. Without their Australian enemies, they grew at record rates. Cooper reported that in 3 years, a seed would become a 45-foot tree with a 9.5-inch diameter. Some eucalypt species failed to withstand California conditions, but one lived up to Cooper's promotion, the fast-growing blue gum, E. globulus, which soon became and has remained a California landmark on roadsides and in windbreaks. The California Department of Forestry distributed thousands of trees of this and other eucalypt species. Arbor Day in California became a patriotic festival of blue gum planting. By the early 20th century, federal and state governments were joining the boom. The Department of Agriculture warned in 1904 that eastern forests had only a 16-year supply of hardwood left, and industrial users of oak, hickory, ash, and other trees appeared eager to accept eucalypt substitutes. The construction of the Panama Canal would make it possible for California wood to reach the East Coast cheaply. In 1908, the University of California College of Agriculture published a bulletin on eucalyptus. Read closely, it had a few warning signals. Most of the wholesale price of eucalyptus oil, praised as an antiseptic and medicinal ingredient, was used up in distilling it. Eucalyptus was better than nothing on mediocre land, but it needed good land to become a profitable tree. It could be hard to cut. Still, the college experiment station recommended eucalypt groves as a more stable source of income than fruit orchards. Authors and promoters sang the profitability of eucalyptus forestry with doubtful data, extolling its virtues as a source for everything from tannin and charcoal to bee nectar and paving blocks. Businesses and private speculators responded. the Joseph R. Loftus Company of Los Angeles sold 2.5 and 5 acre tracts to absentee eucalyptus growers. The trees keep growing night and day, year in and year out, while you may be devoting all your time and attention to something else. Farmers converted cropland to eucalyptus forest. Rancho Santa Fe, now an exclusive San Diego suburb and resort, was originally a blue gum plantation for the Santa Fe Railroad. The Pullman Company's own groves were to supply luxurious finishes to decorate sleeping cars. Jack London, hounded by creditors, at the same time was paying 20 Italian laborers to plant 100,000 trees on his Sonoma Range land. "Everything I can raise and scrape, I am sinking into the planting of eucalyptus trees," he explained in a letter to a job seeker. Neither railroad capitalists nor social writers realized that the rapid growth of blue gum and other eucalypts in California would have a revenge effect. The wood, no matter when it was cut or how it was treated, defied cutting and working. Posts would split across a diameter. Boards would curve out of true while being cut from logs at the sawmill. Cracks would propagate. Worst of all for the railroads, eucalypts were so riddled with fissures that it was impossible to bolt rails to them. Even as windbreaks, the trees were blamed for taking up the water that neighboring fruit trees needed. As the bubble burst, eucalyptus-based industries closed, and imports of Australian eucalyptus oil helped put distillers out of business. The unruly behavior of eucalyptus wood was a mystery at the time. Wood from the same species of trees was serving their native Australia. An Australian forest scientist, Max Jacobs, discovered the real revenge effect decades later. Eucalypts in North America were growing too fast for their own good. In Australia, leaf-eating insects and some fungi slow their rate of growth. Sent around the world as seeds, eucalypts left these predators at home. The trouble was that they had evolved with them. All trees, including eucalypts, develop stresses as they grow. The structure of eucalypts had apparently been optimized for the slow rate of growth with the normal complement of pests. In their absence, the fast-growing trees were booby-trapped by the laws of physics. Under great strains, parts of logs would pull away at the sawmill. The miracle tree simply could not be used for lumber in America. The eucalypts had become problem trees because they had left their own pests at home in Australia. Blue gums were not all uprooted and sold for firewood before the First World War. To the contrary, the tree may have failed as a crop, but it continued to thrive as a suburban ornamental. Towering over the Berkeley and Stanford University campuses, shading the lawns of many of California's costliest neighborhoods, it marks so many landscapes that the state would seem a different place without it. Even in suburbia, the failure of the eucalyptus boom left its stigma. Some communities banned eucalyptus trees as attackers of municipal water lines. Authorities condemned the trees not only for crushing pipes, but for shedding branches on passersby. Some developers' deeds banned blue gums outright, but the blue gum grew too rapidly and too handsomely to stay repressed for long. Eucalypts draped the costly houses of the Berkeley and Oakland Hills overlooking the cities and San Francisco Bay. But planting these trees densely among shake-roofed buildings failed to take into account their most basic behavior. They had evolved with the Australian climate not just to survive fire, but to help kindle and sustain it. Eucalypt branches regularly embrittle, crack, and drop off the tree. The leaves last only an average of 18 months before falling off, not long for an evergreen. Not only branches, twigs, and leaves, but bark, flower buds, and fruit capsules fall regularly to the surrounding earth. This slash, as foresters call it, decomposes quickly in Australian forests. It can accumulate, though, in soil lacking the microorganisms and fungi that can process it efficiently. If all this sounds like preparation for a giant bonfire, one that not only the roots but the trunks of the trees are adapted to survive, it has been just that over and over in California. The Berkeley Fire of 1923, fed partly by eucalyptus litter, destroyed half the city and spilled over to the University of California campus. A smaller brush fire in 1970 swept through 37 homes in the hills above the town. It could have been much worse. Just a few years earlier, a visiting Australian forester was so appalled by Berkeley's assemblage of wooden housing, eucalypts, and accumulated slash that he left his group tour. He retired to his motel room, dazed by visions of an urban firestorm in the making. The conflagration did come on October 21, 1991. Residents had begun to forget the report that followed the 1970 fire, which recommended, among other things, removing eucalyptus trees and building fire breaks. And in the 1970s and 1980s, officials issued a growing number of permits for houses in densely wooded canyons with narrow roads. Most of the new construction had shake roofs, but residents and authorities believed that new fireproofing treatments made them safe. The revenge effect of the chemicals was that they protected individual houses from small-scale fires, but by prolonging the use of shakes, they made a large-scale fire, which overwhelmed them, even more likely. Already in 1976, another wildfire specialist, a professor of fire ecology at the university, was predicting a new catastrophe from the accumulation of combustible material. Yet when he and former students began to cut eucalyptus and Monterey pine with chainsaws to turn the potential hazard into firewood, residents complained to the university and forced them to stop. Of course, neither shake roofs nor eucalyptus trees caused the 1991 fire. California was in the fifth year of a drought, and winds were strong. Construction workers probably started it by burning debris with gasoline, and the Oakland Fire Department may have let the fire reignite after having put it out. We have already seen the interface between suburbs and wildlands as a potent source of fire. The fire burned out power lines serving pumping plants, making it impossible to fill water tanks in the area. Meanwhile, the heat became so strong that emergency generators and portable pumps were useless. By the time 370 engines had contained the fire, 23 people had died, 1,700 acres were burned, and 3,400 housing units were destroyed or seriously damaged, an estimated $5 billion loss. There were 148 injured and 5,000 homeless people. The alarmed observers had been all too right. One study by a Berkeley student calculated that eucalyptus trees had contributed fully 70% of the energy released by burning vegetation in the fire. State and local codes and zoning laws were soon revised to reflect the fire's apparent lessons. Some cautious and affluent residents even covered their rebuilt houses with costly copper roofs with estimated lifespans of hundreds of years. New laws restricted the species and locations of eucalypts and other rapidly burning vegetation, now stigmatized as pyrophytes, literally fire plants. It will still be hard to keep eucalypts out of the reconstructed Oakland and Berkeley Hills for very long, if only because they grow so well and so fast on burned over land. So far, violations of the new code have been rampant. Many residents treasure the shade the plants provide, and recommended replacements like redwoods take a long time to rise. Since many of the new houses are significantly larger than those they replace, there is scant room for the 15-foot distance between house and trees that the law requires. In the mid-90s, collective memories of the disaster persist, reinforced by frequent fire patrols and inspections. Yet the Oakland Hills remain a wildland interface subject to frequent fires. It is not certain that vigilance can last another generation. If it does not, the fire will almost certainly repeat itself. Most of the unintended effects of eucalypts have nothing to do with fire. They arise from the tree's remarkable positive qualities, rapid growth and efficient use of scarce water. Circumstances can transform these into serious problems, not so much for owners as for their neighbors. On the more affluent hillsides of suburban North America, and no doubt in comparable communities elsewhere, one person's shade tree can grow up to be another's nuisance. Residents of Beverly Hills have been known to hire crews to lop neighbors' trees illegally when they obstruct prized prospects. Many of the targets are eucalypts that have crept up inconveniently since the neighbors moved in. Vandals have used chainsaws to cut potentially lethal strips around the trunks of eucalypts, a variation of an ancient technique called girdling, and drilled holes to inject deadly chemicals. There is even a Seattle agency called Plant Amnesty that fights these crimes against nature. The blue gum has survived its bizarre history in this country, from its introduction as a miracle worker and wildland colonist to its apogee as fuel for brush fires, and now is viewed as both a lynching victim and a candidate for protection. Outside the U.S. West Coast, others are following in the footsteps of Jack London. In much of the world, it is poor agriculturalists and not rich homeowners who are trying to destroy eucalyptus trees as pests, and for more understandable reasons. The tree is beginning to take over world forestry. Acreage has expanded from 1.4 million in 1955 to 10 million in 1980, and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, estimates that almost a 500,000 acres are added each year. It already accounts for a third of world pulp production. A eucalyptus tree yields double the wood pulp of a pine tree. But people fearing the loss of olive trees and hardwood forests are unimpressed. Spanish villagers have uprooted thousands of seedlings in new eucalyptus plantations. Thousands of Portuguese farmers have fought police to attack trees. In Iberia and elsewhere, the thirsty eucalypts are blamed for drying up the water of olive and walnut trees and other vegetation. An FAO report on the environmental consequences of eucalypts in the 1980s reached the sensible but not terribly specific conclusion that it all depended on which species, where they were planted, and what other trees, crops, or natural habitat they replaced. More recently, the economics of eucalyptus planting have turned out to be disappointing in Iberia, as they earlier proved discouraging in California. Landowners have stopped planting the tree in Spain, and in fact have bulldozed hundreds of thousands of hectares. Thus, 100 years later, Europeans are repeating something of the U.S. experience. The passionate advocates and enemies of eucalypts, they inspire stronger feelings worldwide than any other group of trees, disagree about a genus of organisms that developed long before modern agricultural science or technology could intervene. New varieties will undoubtedly be bred for specific uses: energy farming, pulp, hardwood. Selection or genetic engineering might reduce the fire risk of eucalypts as ornamentals and might optimize their growth rates and water consumption in particular settings. But since between 550 and 600 eucalyptus species are presently known, depending on the classification rules botanists use, we already have an exceptional choice. The blue gum and other eucalypts may be the best harbingers of the conflicts and dilemmas we might expect from genetically engineered products. Even if eucalyptus-based medicine has lost its cachet, the trees don't appear to threaten human health. And nobody denies how much fiber a stand of eucalyptus can produce, at least for decades. The promoters of the early 20th century were right after all, though not about where it would be profitable to grow the tree and for what purpose. While the forests of the Northeast and South grew back in the 20th century as agriculture receded, worldwide deforestation and soaring paper consumption renewed the eucalypt's prospects. Even so, the divergent opinions of growers and opponents show how different the aesthetic response to eucalypts can be. For the American chairman of a Portuguese cellulose company that has been planting the trees, quote, "Walking in a forest we build is like visiting a cathedral, vaulted, hushed, peaceful," unquote. Another American expatriate finds sheer exaltation in the eucalyptus groves of southern India, with their tall, straight trunks, the loose bark spiraling off in long strips, the sickle-shaped leaves that glint in the sunshine. To others, eucalyptus is a noxious weed, especially to people who, quote, "have seen their olive plantations and vineyards replaced with 20-meter-high blue-green eucalyptus plantations," unquote, as a Swedish professor of environmental forestry put it. A Portuguese environmentalist regards the hillside terraces of trees as a criminal transformation of mountainsides into monumental staircases of eucalyptus. And elsewhere, eucalypts don't just replace marginal agricultural landscapes, they endanger native plant life and wildlife habitats. The American in India acknowledges that local environmentalists detest the eucalyptus, first planted by the British and now ubiquitous, as the enemy of the Shola, their ancient and endangered forests of tangled evergreens. Each of the technological advantages of eucalyptus also has an environmental or social cost. Their natural insect repellents leave little food for birds or other wildlife. Beetles have no appetite for fallen eucalyptus leaves. The tree may reduce local employment with its rapid rate of growth and easily mechanized harvesting. A tree that originally was introduced in North America to help small farmers as well as railroad companies has instead become a worldwide symbol of the intervention of international corporate agriculture and the displacement of the peasantry. The Portuguese left has branded it the fascist tree. Eucalypts, kudzu, and melaleuca show how easily the vigor and adaptability of an organism, the reason for the enthusiasm of experts who sponsor it, can turn one person's, or generation's, miracle plant into another's pest. They also demonstrate that small-scale experiments don't necessarily reveal the potential of an organism. Kudzu was a popular plant long before massive planting brought out its weedy nature. The revenge effects of the recent past have chastened today's professionals, but it's much too soon to say that we are beyond the days of expert-guided pest introductions. The garden columnist, Alan Lacey, has found in current catalogs some plants that may take their place with the weeds that 19th-century seed catalogs helped distribute. Oriental bittersweet, one of the most aggressive weeds, is still for sale. Lacey finds especially ominous the vines Akebia chinata and A. trifoliata, which can grow to 40 feet and are praised in the catalogs as easily grown, vigorous, and trouble-free, all warning signs to the connoisseur of pests. Hybridized, they conquer all surrounding vegetation that much faster. A friend of Lacey's, having innocently planted A. chinata as an ornamental vine on a fence that happened to face an unpleasant neighbor, returned several years after a move. Akebia, without the friend's planning but to his satisfaction, was already overwhelming the neighbor's property. His friend has a new name for Akebia: revenge vine.